This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everyone, this is Clint Locklear from Trappin' Radio, and we're going to do a show today that I am going to do my best not to sound sad. And I'm hoping, since it's been about a week, I can get away with this without getting all quiet on you. But I've had a trapping buddy of mine for the last 14 years that has been to many states, has done everything from coyote and bobcat trapping and snaring and beaver trapping, and would allow me to catch all the otter and stuff I used to catch, and and all that type stuff. And that trapping buddy's no longer with me, and that is actually my dog, Daisy. She's just about turned 15, and it was pretty much just over, and last weekend was the last time I got to spend any time with her, and it was very sad, to be honest with you. I'm amazed how attached you get to something, and even after a week, I catch myself going to the door to let her in, and she's not there, and seeing her out in the yard, and worried about where she's at, and if she's got water, Cindy was cooking the other day and was actually pulling off some chicken, was saving a little bit of the chicken scraps for her until she realized what was going on. I mean, 14 years is that's a crazy amount of time. Most people, I just had to look up the average marriage in America, and it's 3 years. And so I've been with her for so long, and it's just weird. I mean, it's like a person is gone. And, you know, and I'm sure if someone that is an anti is listening to that, they probably are a little bit confused by that, because we're supposed to be bloodthirsty and just love killing stuff and all that type stuff. We hate animals and all the propaganda. But it's, to me, it's just amazing how attached that you can get to a dog. And because sometimes a dog is more than just a dog. And I'm going to go over some of the things that the reason that is true. And we're going to talk about trap line dogs today. And it's kind of a selfish thing for me to do, I realize, because it's going to allow me to maybe get a little bit of closure on this and talk about it. Because the only person that I've even told about this has been Jeff. And Jeff Dunlap about it, and I told him yesterday, he's the first person I said anything to, just for the simple fact it's raw, you know. It's just, and it's really weird, and you know, never really thought about what do you do with a 50-pound dog when they pass. And only thing I could think to do is the last day that she was with us, me and Cindy were planting some more pecan trees, and so that's where we buried her, is next to one of the new pecan trees in the front yard. So she'll be there forever, really. And but I want to talk a little bit about trap line dogs. Now, everybody thinks that their dog is special, or whatever they're doing is special. And Jeff asked me if I thought about getting another dog, and I'm not sure that I will or if I could. Because I've had other dogs besides Daisy, but I really believe that there's only in a person's lifetime that they get the dog. And Daisy was the dog, which I'm getting her to explain. And it's not just talking about my dog today. It's if you have the right dog and they want to be doing what you're doing, and they want to work with you, and they want to please you, and they know that you've got their back. A dog is an amazing animal as far as intellect, at least some dogs are, because of what they can pull off. Now, another thing that'll confuse an anti about this story is when we moved to the house that we're at now, I was trapping for Marion County doing beaver work, and for some reason, I don't know what it is in the springtime, but people just, they throw out dogs all over the place, puppies, dogs, stuff like that. And I'll be honest with you, that's one of those offenses with me that I think a baseball bat should be allowed to be used publicly on TV to do that to a domestic, especially a puppy or something like that. I mean, it's crazy to do that. I mean, it's irresponsible, and people that'll get on the trapper for being inhumane think that it's okay to go turn loose a dog like that, and it drives me crazy. So what you may or may not know about me is I would see all these puppies and stuff, and I'm doing beaver work, and I'm killing beaver by the truckload. But I also would have a couple of bags, big bags of dog food in the back of my truck. When I'd come across these eight or nine, I mean, I can't bring them all home. I mean, there's no physical way to do that. And I would see them and they would be hungry. And I'd always put out, you know, half a bag of dog food. At least before something bad happened to them, they'd have a full stomach. I mean, that's the least that I could do, because there's no way to save all the pets from ignorant people that do stuff like that. And I'm driving between the new house. Cindy hadn't even got in the house yet. I mean, I was painting the living room, and I was trapping, running traps in the afternoon. And I'm going down through Whitwell, Tennessee. And before Whitwell, there's a farm that I was trapping on. And on the side of the road, this little brown dog. And it's sitting on the side of the hill, and it's watching traffic, and didn't have a collar on. And I didn't know if it was just running around or what it was. Well, the next day, that dog was still in the same exact spot. And so I stop, and I go up to it, and the first thing this dog does is roll over on its back for me to pet its stomach. And I'm like, good gosh. So I get it some dog food. The next day, dog's in the same spot. And I go over, and we have a conversation and talk with it. Anyway, that dog ends up in my truck. And according to the vet, because I went and had her head shots and stuff like that, the vet said the dog was about 6 months old at that time. And anyway, Cindy wasn't here. I couldn't leave a dog that didn't know where it was here. So from day two of her being with me, she was on the trap line every day. And I was working for Marion County at the time, and my contract ran for 10 months out of whack. So for 10 months, that dog was with me on a trap line. And D Scrubs, which is a friend of mine, which I'm going to try to get him to do a radio show, just because I think a lot of guys would find it interesting about what the early days of Clint was like working for Marion County, because it was absolutely insanity. D went with me the first day with a dog, and he's, you know, talking about the dog. And I'm not a dog person as far as breeds and this, that, and the other. I mean, I can decipher certain dogs and things, but I'm not a breed. D said it looked like a blackmouth cur. I've heard of that. I didn't know exactly what it was. And Daisy's a female, of course. And part of the thing was I got her fixed. Well, the first day we went out, we're running coyote snares. And after going out with Craig, he said, the only way you're going to teach a dog to avoid snares and traps is to let them get caught. And I was a little nervous of running footholds, which I wasn't running at the time. So me and Dee set out these snares. And I mean, Daisy got caught in snare after snare after snare that first day. I mean, after about the fifth or sixth one, she didn't, I mean, she would feel it around her neck. And then she would just kind of sit down, and she's never been a barker per se. So then me and Dee go back, and we'd turn her loose, and we'd show it to her, and I'd let her smell it, and, you know, and I would say danger and this, that, and the other. And after about 4 or 5 days, she'd get caught maybe once or twice. And when I was running the snares between the beaver snares and the coyote snares at that time, that dog was probably around somewhere between 70, probably 90 to 100 snares a day. And it didn't take her long to figure out. I'm not sure she understood what the snare was exactly at the beginning, but she understood a choke down spot. And that little puppy, which was only 6 months old, would stop and smell all around a choke down spot, even places there wasn't snares. I mean, she associated that really, really quick with a danger. So if a trail got narrowed down, she would start at 6 months old seeing that as a potential area where this thing grabs her around the neck. And so if you're snaring and that you're running lots of snares and you're in a state where other people run snares, there's a little bit of knowledge to be gained from that little 6 month old dog at that point. I'm telling you, animals can learn, and they learn very quickly. Within about a month, Daisy did not get caught in any snares, regardless if she was with me, if I set them with her or not. And it was really cool, because, you know,
she would jump out of the truck. She would always stay a little bit right in front of me. She'd come up, and I got to watch her over and over do this. She would see the choke down spots. She would stick her nose. She wouldn't move her feet. She wouldn't get any closer to it. She'd lean out, and eventually got where she could recognize that snare, and she would just bolt around one side of it and go down the trail. And I was like, you know, that's amazing. I wonder how many coyotes I'm not catching because they survived a snare line, and now are they teaching their pups this, or is this something? Because, you know, a lot of the old woofers really believe that genetically down through, I guess hereditary, that coyotes could teach through bloodline. You know, I mean, they don't have talks. I don't know if, you know, if a coyote would go, a pup would go up to a snare and the mom would bite it on the butt or whatever to get it to do it. But the old woofers really thought, and I'm talking smart guys, that coyotes, if you did something for too long, that the coyotes instinctively knew the danger of it. That's the reason when the 1080 was so popular, the poison from the USDA, it did so good for so long. And then coyotes could actually be raised next to a poisoned cow or horse carcass, and not a pup or an adult would touch it. I mean, think about the discipline of that right there. So I got to watch Daisy do that. And about this time, an interesting thing, I've always done gardening and different things like that. And I was planting tomatoes or corn or something out in the yard. And I hear Daisy just going off. Well, when we moved into this house where the mailbox is, there's a low juniper bush, and it makes like a grid. I mean, that's a tough little plant, and it makes like a grid where, I mean, you can't even see the ground anymore. Well, apparently a groundhog came out, sent a Daisy, saw it, chased the groundhog. The groundhog went under the juniper and was on its back. And Daisy was literally standing on this groundhog on top of this juniper, but couldn't get to it. And, you know, I go over and I'm looking and I'm like thinking, you know, do what you're going to do or leave it alone or something. You're making too much noise. And I go back to what I'm doing. Like 45 minutes later, she's still on top of that groundhog. Can't get to it. I go back over and Daisy happens to look over at me, and when it does, that groundhog, I guess that was what that groundhog's been waiting for, and it reached up through that stuff and bit her. And it bit her on the eye socket, not the eyeball, but above the eye, there where the bone comes out, like if you touch above your eye, and bit her right there. And I'm talking a blood-curdling scream come out. So I go in the house, get the .22, take care of the groundhog. Daisy eventually digs it out, and I mean mauls that thing to death. Her eye got all bloodshot and stuff like that, and it never seemed to really hurt her vision or anything. But to that dog, the shape of that animal, she always thought, at least in her attitude, that a beaver was shaped the same, looked the same, everything. So in her mind, every single time she came across a live beaver, she was thinking it was a groundhog and she was gonna get revenge. Dead beaver in a drowned in a foothold, no problem. One in a conibear, she'd smell it and go about her business, no problem. A live one in a snare, she would bolt, she would jump off a boat into the Tennessee River after one. She would launch off a creek bank on top of one in the water. It was, that's about the only thing I could not break her of. What was just, it was like a hatred for that shape of animal. And it was that way until the very end. Because I guess in her mind, she associated that shape of that animal and getting bit and the pain. And she was going to get even. Well, about this time, probably about a year and a half later, I was doing some work for a duck club out in West Tennessee on the Big Sandy River, which is just on the other side of Nash's Trace, if you know anything about that area. And I was doing a mixture of, I'd run a road line for raccoons in the morning till about 11 o'clock, and then I would get on their four-wheeler, and I would have to go through all these trails and stuff to get to the swamp. And the way the Big Sandy works, it's a really cool thing. It's very expensive property because duck hunters love it. You've got all these ridges, and then at the base of this ridge, it's nothing but swamp. And the swamp goes for miles, and I mean miles, like, you know, 30, 40, 50 miles of this stuff. And it's only about probably 300-400 yards from dry land to the Big Sandy River. And the reason this swamp is there is when the Corps of Engineers went on the Big Sandy River, they straightened it. And they put all their spoil piles on the bank side of one side. So they made like a dam for miles. I know from road to road where I was looking at, because I was thinking about trying to float it until all the locals said you'd never get down through there without 600 people with chainsaws. It was about 10 miles, and it was the exact same terrain for 10 miles of this perfect swamp. So I would go run my road line for coons in the morning, and then I'd get on the four-wheeler. I'd go through all these woods, and I'd come out on this swamp, and they had a boat the first time I ever dealt with a go-devil to get around this swamp. And their swamp probably was about 2 miles in width and about 300 yards in depth. And no really way to put the boat in the river itself without getting in trouble, because the water went up really quick because it was the way the Corps engineer straightened it out. So as you know, if you got in there and the water dropped, you're stuck, the boat's stuck in there. Then if it goes up again, the boat's in trouble because everything comes down the river. So I went down, and Daisy got in the boat very quickly. First time she's been in a boat. She saw me get in the boat. She got in the boat. She kind of liked it. We'd go out and I'd put in, you know, body grips and snares and footholds, and I was targeting beaver and otter. This was, I'm not sure about a year, but it would have been probably the year of or the year after that Claudie Taylor came out with his otter trapping video, because I remember trying to use those techniques in that swamp, which is a lot different than the creeks in North Carolina. So we're out doing that, but on the way driving down through there, I'm seeing some coyote sign and some gray fox sign and a couple of cat tracks. So I call the owner and ask him if he mind if I trap for those, and he goes, no, you know, knock yourself out. Well, now I've got a dog that's only really been around, because I've never had her around dry land footholds at that time, because I just couldn't see that being a very good alternative. And I've already got attached enough to the dog where I didn't want to put it in a situation where it was going to get hurt. But I realized if I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, the dog's going to have to learn to leave sets alone. So I had my proverbial one rubber jaw trap. And I was in this little bitty cabin, and I'm talking little, and had a little porch on the front with stairs going up. And it's just a duck camp. So I went off to the left-hand side of that porch, and I fed Daisy for 2 days once I knew I was going to start trapping outside next to that porch. And then I went to the left of that about 4 feet, and I put in a dirt hole set, a standard dirt hole set. I put lure, bait, urine, gland lure, everything that I knew I'd be using in that hole. She sat there and watched me make the set, and was curious kind of what I was doing. And the whole time I'm telling her danger. Now the danger was the key word when we were getting around snares or body grips. She understood that danger meant something could happen. And she's seen enough stuff in it to really put those two together, it seemed like. So I'm sitting there and I'm putting this set in, I'm telling her danger, and she's sitting there looking at me like the little dog looking at the old record player on RCA, you know, and she's only about a year and a half old. And I put the set in with the weakened down rubber jaw trap, and I stake it down, and I knew she was going to get caught. And I thought it would be just, I figured she probably could pull out of that thing being that weak, and it would just scare her. And after a couple of times, maybe she would start associating it. Because when I was out at Craig's, and he's talking about a trapline dog, he didn't do anything like that. He just took the dogs trapping. They got caught, he turned them loose. They got caught, he turned them loose. And after 4 or 5 getting caught, he's right there anyway. they put two and two together pretty quick. But one interesting thing that he told me when I was out there, because he had a dog at that time, if I remember right, the dog was called Kaiser. And Kaiser was a tough as nails, and it had a lot more of the Airedale in it. And it was not learning the lesson very well, but it was extremely good at calling. And that dog, Craig said, he had to catch that dog probably 60, 70 times before it actually figured anything out, because it was so aggressive in nature that anything that was strange like that, it was going to go over and prove its dominance. So I'm listening, you know, I'm thinking back to that, and Daisy does not have that temperament of that dog, and I'm like thinking, well, surely the goodness, it won't take her that many times. I set the trap, blend it in, do everything just like I would at a set. I get done, I'm putting stuff in the bag. Daisy sees me starting to leave, and she takes one step towards the trap, and I raise my voice, and I go, and I tell her, no danger. And I tell her it's going to hurt her if she gets in there. And she sat there for about 10 minutes, and she circled that thing, and she looked, and she sniffed, and she stretched out as much as she could. And every time she would kind of creep up, I'd get on to her a little bit. And you know that trap set next to that dog food bowl where she ate out of 4 foot away for 2 more weeks, and she never once worked the set. That's what I'm saying. I don't think all dogs have the mental capacity or whatever it is in a dog to be able to do what I got to do with Daisy, which made our relationship so much tighter. So then, after a couple of days of seeing her not get in it, I just started putting Bobcat and Coyote and Fox sets in the ground. And in her mind, it was the same as what I did at the cabin. And from her first time out, she never got caught in a set. And she never, over 14 years, guys, got caught in a foothold trap. She got close a couple of times. I played around with some deer leg sets before, and she just, it just drove her insane. And she tried to sneak around it, and one of them snapped off but didn't hold her. And it was actually quite funny, because I watched her, and I told her, you know, I'm like, girl, that's going to get you. And she tried to sneak around a tree. She tried to low crawl over to it. She wanted that deer leg so bad she couldn't stand it. Well, when the trap went off, it almost like it embarrassed her. And the door of the truck was open, and she ran over. She got in the truck, and she went over the passenger side seat. And she's sitting up kind of like a person anyway. And I go over, and I'm laughing. And that dog turned her back on me because it was like she was embarrassed. That was the only time, really, that she just was so tempted that she couldn't handle being around foothold traps. So by the time she was a year and a half old, I would have made a bet with anybody, and I'd have won the bet that you couldn't snare my dog. The other thing is, if you're using lure or urine or gland lure at a set, you couldn't catch my dog. Which goes back to having a curious mind. What does that mean as far as wild animals, as far as fox and cats and coyotes and even raccoons and stuff like that? How much are they putting two and two together where if you do the same thing over and over and over again, and your neighbors are doing the same thing over and over again, they just learn to avoid the sets just like Daisy did? And I've always wondered that, because there's no way that I know of that you could really, you know, quantify that in any type of statistic or anything like that. You'd have to put, you know, like wide range heat seating drone cameras up or something to be able to see what was really going on. But it was one of those things that it's always chewed on me. And even when I took her, and I was really nervous of this, the first time I went to Mississippi, you know, you can set the body grips on top of the ground. And I was really nervous if she would associate one with the other. And no problem whatsoever. She wouldn't even, she's seen so much stuff get killed in the body grips. I mean, and she could see them. She wouldn't get within 3 feet of them on dry land. And I mean, I'm talking, she wouldn't stay with me. She'd run off. Now, with foothold traps, with a dog that's individually trained that way, or you train it that way, or however that works in a dog's head, there was one set I could not use if I had Daisy with me, or I couldn't let her out of the truck, which was a problem when she was younger, because she didn't want to get in the truck. She wanted to run in front of the truck if we were actually at a trapping property. Is the Mafia set, the double coil spring or long spring blind set in a trail with a dropping in between them. That would catch Daisy within 30 or 40 seconds of her being in the area every single time. It was the dangest thing I've ever seen. And I would know it instantly, because she would bark and whine, and I'd go over and I'd just let her out, and she would go back to the road or wherever it was. And I mean, she had this look on her face, is like, you know, you didn't put up the signage to let me know not to step here. And you know, and it would almost look like she would be, you know, like you're just being a peckerhead for doing that. But it taught me animals that even get habituated to lure or sets or anything like that, it's almost like a double trapped blind set, a Mafia set with a dropping in between. There's no defense against that, which was an amazing learning experience to me, because that led me down the road of using sets as decoys and using blind sets away from them and different things like that. And as I became a little more savvy in the way that I was coyote trapping, Daisy was getting up in age to the point where when she hit about 10 years old, I mean, she had a crazy active life. She's trapped in more states than most trappers have. She couldn't stand running as much as she did. So I knew that if I started at 7, by 10 or 11, she'd be pretty much burnt from walking, and she would just kind of watch me out of the window of the truck, you know, and which was fine. And I could start putting in these more creative blind set, decoy sets, stuff like that. And that really, I think, is what has, watching Daisy has really elevated my understanding or creativity in trapping, I guess, is to say. And there was a lot of things that I got to watch her do day after day after day that was amazing. If the road was muddy and mud puddled up and sloppy and stuff like that, after so long, I could guess where she would, what side or what ridge or how she would go down that road. And sure enough, if I followed her, I could see where the coyote tracks were. She would go to the same places to stay out of the mud and the slop, just the way the coyotes were, because she's a canine. And then that started changing my locations up a little bit when it, you know, from good weather and dry weather to real bad weather. After seeing that over and over again, now I can look up about any road that's in bad shape from weather and go, okay, they're going to be up there, down there, over there. And it taught me a lot of things when it comes to snaring. And when I was out at Craig's, and I'm talking about Craig O'Gorman, if you don't know who he is, the first time I did instruction, I was out there a week, which I don't think he does anymore. And I think it was day 4 or something. He's like, so what do you want to go over today? And I'm like, bobcats. And he showed me some of his draws that he was snaring for bobcats. And a lot of it was made perfectly good sense. You got the cattle trails coming down through these things. It looks flat out there, but some of these draws would be like 20 feet in the ground. And the cattle would come down inside of these draws to get out of the weather, I assume. And they had all this juniper and sage and stuff, and they had these really burn-in trails, and you know, you block those down, you catch your cats. But there was a lot of these little locations that Craig had that didn't make a lot of sense to me at the time until I saw Daisy do this over and over and over again. You may have a main trail, and it could be open in those draws. Those draws aren't necessarily thick like they are in the east. And you have these trails going down the draw, and I mean, it's talking, the trail is 6-8 inches beat into the soil. I mean, it's obvious what it is. Ain't a bit of grass on them. But if you start getting into some of the junipers, or there's some sage down there, every now and then he'd show me where he's putting snares, and they were completely off the trail, but it was off to the side of these trails, and there'd be three or four or five of these things kind of lined up or in a clump, and the animals would get off the trail and they would skirt the outside of that. And I was trying to logically formulate a reason why they was doing it. But what I saw Daisy do over and over and over again, even if you had, say, a road that was decently maintained, and they grow the buckwheat and the alfalfa and the clover and stuff on the side, so it's really green. Well, if there's a row of trees off to the side of that, up next to the wood line, and it's enough you could walk around comfortably, what I noticed Daisy doing in situations like that over and over and over again, or a spoil pile, or where they piled a bunch of stuff up, she would get off the road and she would go to the outside edge of that, between that and the tree line, over and over and over again. And so I started, you know, after seeing that many, many times, I'd go over and I'd start putting these sets in. And sure enough, I'd start picking up these animals. And no matter what was going on with the road, there was something about, in my mind, which I'm probably wrong, it's kind of like, well, I just got to see what's over there. They're kind of like a friend of mine, Ed Blue. He's got the Lewis and Clark syndrome. He's just got to see what's over the next hill all the time. He's like an explorer. And I think these coyotes and fox do the same thing. They see all this openness, and then all of a sudden there's something they really can't see because of the brush or whatever, and they got to go check it out. And they go on the outside edge between that and the wood line. So I learned that, which reinforced what I saw with Craig, but I didn't understand it at the time. But I saw Daisy do this, so I got to see how she would work different roads. Then it turned into a game with her. I would sit in the truck and look up ahead of us, and I would try to guess what was she going to do ahead of me, or where was she going to go, or was she going to cut down the game trails that I knew were coming up, or was she going to start stalling out in a gap over a ridge, or in a low spot on a road, or whatever. You know, what was she going to do? And you know, how she worked levees was not always what I thought it would be, because there'd be a good game trail right on top, and sometimes she wouldn't even get on it. And I started, you know, going, I'd still do my normal sets, but then I would start playing around with these other ones, and it started opening up my view of locations over and over again, which I could not have done without all those hours. I'm talking thousands and thousands of hours with this dog. So it led me down this road where it made me a better trapper to have this animal with me. And it was really cool. Now, me saying this, I don't want anybody to get the impression that you can go out and just get a dog and it's going to be like this. I think you can learn from any dog. But when you go out trapping with a dog, it has to be a dog, guys, like I said, that wants to be there and wants to be part of what you're doing, and like part of the team. And instinctively, that dog has got to be like that. And I've had other dogs that would love to go to the woods, and they would love to run around, but they're about as smart as a tree stump, and they could care less what I wanted them to do. And they would run off, and you got to chase them down. They'd go screw with somebody's, you know, chickens, or try to chase a horse. And a dog, as good as a dog can be on a line, at the same time, the right dog is what you're looking for, and there's no way of knowing that. And the wrong dog is just detrimental. Because once Daisy got out of the puppy stage and she matured just a little bit, all those issues that I've had with other dogs trying to, you know, do the trampoline dog thing with them or just have dogs went away. And she, it was like she knew that we were going to work and our mission was X, Y, and Z. And she was trying to figure out how to make that easier for me. Now, as smart as she was, there were certain things that she would not do. No, I'm watching her, and you know, I can tell, you know, I'm using extension cables and all this type stuff, and this was before I really got into the drags. As soon as I got out of the truck, or if she was running in front of the truck and I had a flat set that I really couldn't see, I could watch her body language, and if there was something there, I could instantly know, get out of the truck, take care of the situation. So she allowed me some room there. But when I went to drags, first, I didn't have something like a saber tooth to use as drags. I was using the you know, just the bent re-rod looking things with the ground points on them. And you know, those are okay in very certain situations, but it's not a drag. It's just going to make you a happy person in the long run. Too many crazy things happen. So I go and she's around me, she always checks in where I'm putting these sets in, and I'm putting the drag, and at the time I thought I had to bury the drag and all this type stuff, and I caught several animals with these cheap drags, and the cheap drags would normally mean now I had to go spend all this time looking for them because the design of the drag didn't do what the saber tooth does as far as locking them up quick, because I'm not using the drag so much to get the animal away from something. It's just I don't want to be the stake in. But these cheaper drags would allow the animal to get out of the area, even in thicker cover a lot of times. Daisy would go up and smell these sets, and her body language would say that something happened there. And she would kind of like wander around a little bit, then she would go down the road towards the next set. I could never get her to understand that her job or the mission of this day was to go find that animal. She would look at me, and I swear to goodness, this is what she was thinking. And I would try to like talk her into or reason with her of why she needs to help me look for this dog. I mean, this other coyote or cat or fox or coon or whatever it is that I've caught. And I swear she'd look at me and go, look, big man, if you're going to be a dumbass and not stake it to the ground, you got to go find it yourself. And it was that way every single time it came up to a drag that she couldn't see or hear the animal right there at the location. Now, once I started going to the saber tooth and a coyote, you know, about the farthest I've ever had a cow go is about 40 yards, and that was because of a frozen field. The movement would be there, the sound would be there, and she would automatically key on it quicker than I would, and it worked out better. But it wasn't because she was a trained drag dog. And I've been around some trained drag dogs. They go up like Craig's. They go up to the set, they see it's disturbed, they smell the other animal that's been there, and they track it down. So that's the reason, like, when if you're with a trap line dog, like with Craig, as soon as he sees the trap's gone, before he even looks around, he grabs his remake, he opens the dog box, the dogs get out, and they start tracking the animal down. He grabs his stuff, goes, sets it next to the set, and by the time he stands up again, those dogs are either really close already at the animal and barking, and he goes over and dispatches it and comes back and remakes his set. That was not going to happen with Daisy. No matter how many treats I tried to give her or anything like that, it was not going to happen. But with an animal that wants to be part of the team and has somewhat of the intelligence level to know what you want, they can do amazing things. Now, what I'm getting ready to tell y'all is the absolute truth when it comes to what a good dog can do for you. All the times that I would go in, you know, in the winter time, it's cooler, it's, you know, you're feeling more frisky, this, that, and the other. So I would, you know, I didn't have turtle problems as bad. If I caught otters, that was good. You know, so I was using more of the body grips and the footholds, and I would use some snares. But in the winter, I was more along those lines. When the summer came, I didn't want to screw with the turtles, even though you still snared some every now and then. I could have the loops big enough where it seems like almost all the otter could get through the snare. They may knock it down, but they don't get caught. And I could do the snares, and plus, because I'm a fat guy, I didn't want to be carrying around all that iron, and I could just have, you know, a handful of kill poles or snare supports and some snares, and I could go out and snare beaver and do my job for Marin County very good. So she got to see, when we would go into snaring beaver, there may be 5 months out of the year that all Daisy was seeing pretty much, unless it was an odd situation where I had to use another piece of equipment, it would have been snares. And Daisy would, when I went to a new piece of property, she'd always stay close. It's like she knew to stay close. And, you know, I would be talking, and you know, after a while, your dog turns into like a person with you anyway. And, you know, you're talking about philosophy and cussing politicians and all this. And she's looking at you like she's agreeing with you. And, you know, and it's really good company. Well, one day, there was this little bitty, it's right about Whitwell behind water treatment plant, and there's a farmer down there that's having beaver problems, and it's a very unique property. You've got a great big ridge that comes off, and then it flattens out really, really quick, and it's probably about a 400 acre field, and the Squatchie River is on one side of it. Well, when it floods, it makes a cut around that ridge, because we get a lot of flooding here. And I don't mean raising water, I'm talking flood. And over the years, it made this cut right at the base of the ridge. And it turned into like a oxbow slough kind of type thing, with a road going across it to the field. And I'd pull up on that, and we'd go set the snares. Well, one day, I pull up, and the phone rings. And Daisy gets out, and she goes, and I notice her going, doing the same path we were on, checking the beaver snares. And sure enough, we had a beaver, and she starts barking and raising cane and doing the monkey dance all around it, and trying to figure out how to get a bite of it to get back at the groundhog, since she was a puppy. And I go over, and I dispatch the beaver, and I'm resetting the snare, and sure enough, about 60, 70 yards down, she starts the same process. And I'm like, that dog is checking the snare line. And sure enough, I go down there, and she's doing the monkey dance again, jumping and hopping all around this beaver. And this time, I mean, I throw the love to her. I'm petting her. I always carried Slim Jim sticks with me for treats when she did something. I bet she ate like three of them right then. I mean, the more she did it, and then she ran off checking more of the snares. And somehow in her brain, she just knew where the path was probably. She went down and checked the snare. I came up to her and kind of praised her, and, you know, that's cool. You know, this, when she did it again, my light bulb in my head went off and said, she's checking these snares. And I really, really, you know, made her know that she did a good job, and I gave her treats and this, that, and the other. And as soon as I started putting that snare off, I mean, she ran out of there like her tail was on fire to go check the next one. Now, we didn't have another one there, another beaver there that day. The next day, we pulled up, and I'm curious, so I opened the door of the truck and let her out. Sure enough, she goes straight down that snare towards the far end. She starts barking. I go up to her. She's doing the monkey dance all around the beaver. I'm petting, praising, telling her how smart she is. I give her treats, take care of the beaver, reset it. She takes off. She checks the rest of the snares. So then, over the next about 4 or 5 days, I pull up. I kick open the door. She goes and she checks. Not every day she had anything. After she comes back, just because I wanted to make sure what she was doing, I would go check them. She never missed a beaver in a snare. Ever. On this one piece of property. So then when I would come up to places like that, I got in the habit of, I would let her out first and give her a head start. And whenever she would go check the snares, I'd praise her. After about 3 months of that, and doing multiple test checks, if it's a property that I was going to have to walk in, or, you know, it's not a huge, huge property where it was many miles in between, I could pull up, open the door, let her out. She would go check the snares. If I had something, she let me know. If not, she would run straight back to the truck and get jump in the door, and they're like, let's go, let's go, let's go. And that dog, think about how energy efficient that is. I mean, just from a haphazard thing, that dog learned it could check snares. I couldn't do it with body grips underwater, and I couldn't do it with footholds on sliding rods. But if I was just running snares and it's hot and I'm fat and the mosquitoes are out in groves and the ticks are, you know, they're having toga parties hanging off of the bushes waiting on you, she could bolt through there and do that job easier, which allowed me to go set more properties because the dog can move faster than I could through that type of terrain. And that's part of the reason I got a lot of the numbers that I did on Beaver, is because the dog could go check them for me. And it was really, really cool. So I'm like thinking, well, this is just slicker snot. Well, about that time, the auto prices got really, really, really high. I mean, it's hard for me to judge years anymore, but I would say, man, because I was a whole lot younger. 10, 12 years ago, otter went from like $12 to 40 to 60. And then there was a few accounts of people getting 80 and 90. And then the next year, every otter was a $100 bill. And on the Delta otter, which were really light in color, a lot of those otter were bringing, you're probably averaging $150 average on those really light gray, they call them silvers. And I mean, they were light gray otter and big in the Delta. So me and Ed, we went out to Mississippi, and we're running all these fish ponds. And if you've never seen big fish pond operations, if you can imagine, they could be crawfish, which is a little different but similar, or they could be these big catfish ponds. And I'm sure up north or different places they have different fish they raise this way. But if you can imagine a smaller one's probably 50 acres. And these ponds are anywhere from an acre to 3 acres probably. And they're normally squared and gridded off, and there's road systems in between, just kind of like levees with grass on them, but they keep them cut. So the grass is only, you know, even if they hadn't cut it in a while, 8-9 inches high, because a lot of geese and stuff come there and they keep the grass cut for them. Well, you can see across a great big span of stuff. Well, me and Ed are, you know, we took Daisy with us, and we got to watching her, and she would roll on the scat at the beaver, the otter toilets. And, you know, at first we're like, good grief, she's got that crap all over. She, you know, we're in a, she's in the front. Daisy never went in the back of a truck. And anybody that's been with me trapping knew, you may get the person in the front seat next to me, even students, for a while. She will get her spot back. Her spot was the passenger side next to me. People were secondary if they were riding along, because they weren't part of the team. And so Ed was doing a lot of the driving. Daisy was in between us, and I was on the passenger side. So we knew that this otter scat was going to be, because, I mean, she rolled it with enthusiasm. Well, then she got up, and we, you know, we're kind of complaining about we're gonna have this crap all over us before the day's over with. And she's running around and sniffing and going back and forth, being a dog. She comes across another one, and she rolls in it. And me and Ed kind of look at each other about the same time. We both had the light bulb moment. And so we walk over to her, and I start praising and rubbing and belly scratching and give her some more Slim Jims and this, that, and the other. And she goes along. Then every time she rolled in that otter scat, I mean, she thought that she painted the Mona Lisa or saved a baby out of a burning building. I mean, that's how much praise I heaped upon her when she did it. It didn't take her but probably five or six of those to, for some reason, those two guys over there like it when I roll in the crap from whatever this animal is. And they think I'm doing something really good, so I need to go find more otter crap. And that's what she started doing. On that trip, it started forming. On trips after that and around here, it became the most easiest, I'm not going to say ingenious because there was no ingenious part of it, but crazy efficient way to otter trap if you had cover or could keep Daisy next to you. So imagine, and people wonder, you know, when they see some of the otter pictures that I've taken, you know, and I've taken over 100 otters for several years there when they were high. How in the world was I doing that in such short spurts? Well, it's because of my dog. Not because I was such a great trapper, but I paid attention, and she knew what her part of the team was. So now I could roll up to a fish pond or a crawfish pond or somebody's lake, because she would do it around lakes. Anywhere that I could have visual, I would just open the truck door and tell her to go find the toilets. And I'd get her hyped up, and she would take off of there as fast as she could, and she would start running the edge. And she always went, which was to me was interesting. And I noticed the craziest things probably. If you were looking at a lake, she always went to the right. Don't know why, didn't matter what the wind was, but she always went to the right. So I would, if it was a lot of ponds or a big pond, I could pull over, open the door, get her hyped up, send her on her way. I could take out a Coke or get a cup of coffee, and I would just watch. And for you guys that have otter trapped around ponds, you know exactly what it's like to do that. If you can't drive, you walk around the pond, because otter, there are certain things that they do pattern wise from pond to pond. If there's an inflow or an outflow pond, a lot of times they'll play around that. If there's, it's a corner or where it's the closest to another body of water or a creek, they'll cross there. Sometimes it's just in the corners, but you got to get out and you got to walk that. If you can't get a four-wheeler, and you walk all the way around this pond to find the otter crossings. And as you're crossing them, you're going, okay, that's a good one, that's two traps. This is a really big one, that's four traps. And you're getting your inventory in your mind about what you need to come back and set them up. Then you walk all the way around this thing, and then you go back, you get all your equipment, you drive as close as you can to them, and then you're setting these things up. Well, part of the advantage I had because of Daisy is I could pull up, get my cup of coffee, get her hyped up, kick her out. She would go. She knew what I wanted her to do was find and roll in that stuff. So I would just watch. And she'd be bolting around through there, and a dog can see and smell better than we can. And I mean, she would lock her brakes up. She would roll. She would physically look at me, you know. And I'd be hauling out her, telling her how good a job she's doing. But in my mind, I'd go one. And then she'd go around that pond, she'd find another one, two. She'd go around, maybe there's a third, maybe there's a fourth. And some of these ponds, there was five and six, because the way that they are all interconnected. So by the time she went from right to left and came back to the truck, I had a number, and I knew I didn't have to spend 1 second looking for them because she showed me where they were at. Think about how intense that is from an otter trapper's point of view. She didn't do it on nutria trails, and she didn't do it on beaver trails. She did it on otter toilets because she knew that's what I wanted her to do because I kept praising her. So I would pull up. I would watch her. I could count my traps. When she got back, I would know I needed 8 traps. I would look and see if I could drive somewhere to get closer. If not, I would just throw them in the bag or in my hands, and I would take off, and I could go straight to that point. I could block it up, go to the next one, block it up, go to the next one, block it up. The time saving that gave me on otter was an advantage that very few people ever have. And we could do that pond after pond after pond and day after day after day. Now, when I get in places that I couldn't do that, it was almost just as good, but not just as good. So if we're in somewhere that's got really thick and you can't see like you can at the fish ponds or someone's fishing lake, Daisy would be in front of me 15, 20 feet, boy, she always was, looking around, smelling, peeing, this, that, and the other. And then I would see, she would come across the trail, and she'd always kind of do the same thing. She'd kind of run her nose up and down to it, left or right or up and down, however you want to say it. And then she would find the scat and roll in it. She would look. And after a while, she wouldn't get off of that until she saw me looking at her, and I'd give her some praise. And then what I would normally do is drop the traps right there on the trail where there's no way I could miss them, and then I would just follow the dog. And if she came across another one, I would drop the next couple of traps and the next couple of traps. And when I got to the end of what this property or this water, a lot of times on creeks or rivers, then I would walk back, and as I was walking back, the traps were already on the location. I would set the traps up. I mean, amazing trapping when you have something to do like that. And I don't know because I'm not a dog trainer. I've been around some guys that really got into the dog training thing, like Blackie was with his Rockwaller, or Scott is out in New Mexico with his little Jack Terriers. I'm not sure that every dog can do that. I know I've had dogs in the past that couldn't. I mean, they were just good dogs. They stayed around the yard. They ate your food. They barked at people if they came up and tried to bite the UPS man. But they were not, they just would never have figured that out. And if you can imagine all those hours and all that time that I spent with that dog and all the cool things that we did together and saw together. And my wife has said several times, if she came back and was reincarnated, it was going to be around me. She wanted to be the dog. I mean, the dog was spoiled to no end. But, you know, I didn't care because it's not like the dog's going to grow up and rob banks or be a smart aleck or do something or steal from people or something like that. She knew, and we became very good friends, and there's no other way to say that except for that, and we were a team. Now, for me to get a new dog now, if the intelligence level is not the same, it's not fair for the dog nor for me, because I'm not sure that I would be able to put that kind of time again into a dog if it wasn't genetically there. And I didn't pick Daisy for this. She was just a stray that I found off the side of the road. And you know, it was a lot of other things that we did that was really cool. Travis, my right-hand man here that does a lot of bottling stuff for me, he's a big rabbit hunter, and he was asking me if Daisy went rabbit hunting. And I told him, yeah. But I didn't have to take a gun when she was younger. And there was, once I figured out the pattern, I was fine with it. We would be out during rabbit season, and that'd be the only time that I would pay attention to rabbits when they would run. And Daisy could pick up on that I was paying attention to the rabbits when I was running. And as soon as one would take off, I'd say, go get them. And she would take off. I never needed a gun because she would literally chase the rabbit down and bring it back to me. Like it was a tennis ball. And it was amazing, even though it may take, you know, an extra 3 minutes on a beaver job somewhere to see her chase down a rabbit in a in a 100-acre field with nothing in it. I mean, that's what you live for, stuff like that. I mean, it's just amazing to see. It's like, if you could slow it down, it'd be like the old Mutual Omaha footage, you know, with the lynx trying to catch the snowshoe hare or something. The first rabbit of the day, she either ate it or buried it. I don't know what she did with it, but it wasn't mine. After that, she would just bring them back, drop them at my feet. I would put them in my bag after I gutted it and go about my business. That was my form of rabbit hunting with a dog. Squirrels, because black mouth curs are not really barkers. They will bark. They can bark, but they hardly ever bark. She would kind of whine if she treated a squirrel. And I'd have to have a gun for that. And during squirrel season, if I had permission, I'd look up in the tree when we're trapping, because to me it's just adding function. I like squirrels, so if a squirrel showed up, she treated it, it's going home with us if we had permission to. The first three squirrels I didn't get to keep, because she would eat them instantly. After that, I'd shoot it out of the tree, she'd go over and smell it and go find the next one in between trapping. Which I was fine with. You know, I mean, it didn't really bother me. Some days I didn't get any squirrels because we only saw two. But it was just a cool way, to go about it. And, you know, if you're the one of the neat things about a dog that's in tune to you, if you're upset, the dog almost seems to do things or get up close to you. And you know, almost like there's empathy there to, you know, I feel your pain, big man, you know, stuff like that. And that part's really cool. And if you're in an excited mood, the dog's in an excited mood. And it's just really, really cool things. Now, there's some certain things with dogs you got to be careful of. They're hard to road trap with, no matter how smart they are. Because if something happens, they focus on whatever's going on and not the cars. So a lot of times I'd have to leave her in the car when I was road trapping, which she didn't like. But I would always make sure that I had somewhere to go during the day that she can run around and do her thing. But she was with me all the time. I mean, she from 5, 6 in the morning till I got home in the evening, she had watched me skin. She got to eat the beaver meat. She'd go with me on the boat. She wasn't as crazy about muskrat trapping, probably because the action's not the same. But she would eventually get bored and just go to sleep somewhere in the boat and get out on the bank every now and then and stuff like that. But she never really got that. She'd want to go, but she wasn't too fired up about just boat trapping out of a boat all day unless it was beaver. And, you know, apparently blackmouth curs like to swim, because one of the days, I mean, it was weird, because she always stayed really close for the most part. And if I called her, she would always come, because she knew we was going somewhere else. The dog figured out, you go in somewhere, you leave somewhere. You go in somewhere, you leave somewhere. It's not like you go there and hang out at a picnic all day. One day, we're on the Tennessee River down by South Pittsburgh, and that part of the river has got to be half mile wide. It's definitely over a quarter mile wide. And I'm putting in beaver sets, and I call Daisy, and she doesn't come. And I walk up on the bank, and I call, and she doesn't come. I walk up and down the bank a little bit, and I'm getting kind of frustrated, and she's not coming. Well, I go back down to the boat to see if she got in the boat and went to sleep. She's not in the boat, and I happen to look across the river, and there she sat over a quarter mile away on the other side of the bank looking at me like, are you coming or not? She got in. Apparently, she saw or smelt something over there, and she swam the whole river to go check it out. So every now and then, it can be a time sucker to have a dog. It's just the way it is. But what I will tell you, if you find the right dog that wants to be part of the team, there's always going to be something that you can pick up from it. Not 100%. But most of the time, if we were doing predator work, the dog will go to and pee on and scratch on, because in her mind, I mean, you got to think, almost every animal she came in contact with didn't make it out of the situation breathing. So in her mind, she was part of the dominant team going into the wilderness. Even though she was a girl, she didn't squat. She lifted her leg like a boy. And she scratched up like an alpha male. The ground. That's just the way her mindset was. And if she came across a really good urine spot on a trap line, she would pee and scratch and go over and try to get a couple more drops on there. Then she would scratch. She would tear it up. And I mean tear it up. Well, I knew exactly then where the trap needs to be. And then I would try to connect the dots from that point of, are the coyotes on the road? Are they on the edge line? Are they coming down the trails or whatever? And because I knew I had that focal point, I would set the focal point, then set out from that. And she also taught me one thing. A lot of guys will use coyote urine, fox urine, or cat urine. Well, because of Daisy, I didn't use any urines after a while. She could pick a commercial urine out just like she would if it was Boss Dog. I mean, she could instantly tell if it was authentic or fake. The authentic, and I've tried to trick her several times, the authentic, she'd go and she would scratch and pee and show her dominance and this, that, and the other. The commercial stuff, she would just ignore like it wasn't even there. And after seeing that for so long, I'm like, well, if she's that way, probably some other animals are that way. And it's just an expense that I didn't have to have, was the urine. So I quit using it, and I couldn't tell any difference on my catch. But, she's the reason, after watching her over and over again, where you couldn't fool her into even paying attention to commercial urine. She may go up and smell it, but she's not going to pee on it, and she's definitely not going to scratch it. There's something different there, whether the age or the different animals, or I don't know what it is, because I couldn't talk with her. But she would tell me this every single time, so that's the reason I don't use the cow urine. But that was one of those things that sometimes when I couldn't figure out where the coyotes were, she would show me. And when she started acting dominant, I knew that it was coyotes. She wouldn't really do it to fox, and she really wouldn't do it to cats. But if it was coyotes, I mean, she would definitely throw down the canine gauntlet, and which is probably unfair to the canines. So besides me just having a little bit of time as far as closure of my trap line dog, I thought I'd talk a little bit about that, because with the right dog, guys, it'll elevate your trapping to no end. But at the same time, I believe the wrong dog, it's going to be frustrating for you and frustrating for the dog. And I don't care. I never had to use shock collars or anything with her, but I don't care if you use shock collars or a switch or a gruff voice. If a dog doesn't have it, a dog's not going to have it. And my suggestion is, because I'm not a dog trainer, is start them young. When they do what you want them to do, really praise them. Let them know they've done something right every single time. I was very consistent in that. Every time she rolled in otter scat, even if I was in a bad mood, hot, or dying a heat stroke, she got a good praise session going on. She knew that I was happy with what she was doing. Same thing with the beaver. When she would scratch and tear up a clump of grass where cows have been peeing on, she knew that's what I wanted. If we were going down the road, she would stop and smell every coyote, cat, or fox trapping and look back at me. And I'd always tell her, good job. And then she'd go about her business. She realized that the droppings were important. She would stop to make sure that I was looking at her. And once she knew that I saw that she stopped at that drop, and she would go about her business. Amazing dog to do that with. If you're looking for a trap line dog, you're running a gamble or a risk if it's the right trap line dog, because I don't see how you're going to know if it is or it isn't. But if you have the right one, guys, you'll have something that's amazing. But the downside of it is it doesn't last forever, and the dog's probably not going to outlast you. And that's rough. I can tell you that is rough. And I don't think it's the same if it's just a household pet as it is if you get a really good trap line dog. Now, if you're the type person, and I'm not, but if you're the type person that can keep it where it's totally professional and totally the dog is a tool to help you with whatever you're doing, I think the dog can be happy in that situation, and at the end it's not as rough on the person. But I mean, I know some really gruff trappers, you know, that Bob Jamison's a good example. When him and Newt flipped their boat with that wind shear out in New Jersey, and they both about died of hypothermia, and they finally got saved, you know, they both have health issues from that today. The big lab that Bob Jamison had all those years that everybody saw at conventions, it really messed that dog up being in the water that long. And that dog had to go, you know, try to find somewhere to get on something eventually. And when Bob was writing that story, even though I knew Bob and I knew Newt, and I'm good friends with both of them, and I have a lot of respect for them, but more than that, just the personal relationship with both of them. I mean, that's sad. You can feel, you know, emotionally what that must have been like. But when Bob saw his dog go off and didn't think he's going to see it again, not only with me, Bob told me that's most people, when they saw Bob, didn't ask about Newt or the other guy or anything. They asked how the dog was. So that's how emotionally attached you get to somebody. Because, I mean, that dog was, I don't know if it went trapping with Bob or not, but it went to conventions with him all the time. So that was kind of, you know, Bob's buddy. And after that point, arthritis and all kind of stuff went crazy with it just because it was so intense of a situation. But it was, it can play an emotional tie. And I'm not saying not to get a dog, to get that close to a dog because of the end when the life of the dog is over. But just be aware of that from the beginning. And but if you find the right one, guys, holy cow, is it a cool thing. I mean, it's, I don't think without Daisy that I would be near the trapper that I've got to be because of everything that she taught me. We're going to close up. And I'll talk to y'all next week.